Welcome to Built to Go, a van life podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Wagg, coming to you from the College of Curiosity. This time it's episode 209. We're going to talk about the difference between van life and RVing. I mean, are they the same thing? Is one part of the other? Or are they completely different? We're also going to talk about tire plugs and a brand new one that I was just introduced to, an undermount 12-volt air conditioner that you need to consider if you have a fairly big budget, and a place to visit that you're not going to, and I know why, but maybe you should go there. Welcome, everybody. Thank you for joining me once again here for episode 209. I am in two different worlds. I am in the van life world because I've built out a couple of vans, and I have a van that I have built out. It is a legit van life van, even though it used to be an ambulance. And I also have now a bunch of RVs. I have three RVs right now and a truck that I'm going to turn into a truck camper kind of thing. So I'm kind of in these different communities, and I follow them all. And of course, I've been in the RV community for a very long time. I had my first RV when I was 20, and that was my daily driver. And then I got into van life 5 years ago or so. And it's interesting to me that they're the same thing, except they're really not. They're really very different things. And I thought maybe I would spend a little bit of time with you and delineate the differences and the similarities. But big caveat, big disclaimer here. Everything I'm about to talk about is a complete generalization. There are exceptions to every single thing I'm going to say here. This is about stereotypes and generalizations and trends. They're interesting to observe, but they're not that important. Don't let anything I'm about to say stop you from doing what you want to do in the vehicle you want to do it in. Okay? We have that agreement? Excellent. Okay, so RVs, recreational vehicles, tend to be commercially made. There aren't that many people building their own RVs. Now, again, if you build out your van and you camp in it, have you built an RV? Okay, maybe. But let's be real here. When you hear the term RV, you're thinking of a Winnebago or a Coachman or a Great Northern or a Sanibel or one of the hundreds and hundreds of different brands of RVs. And they're generally white, although the colors are changing a lot lately. They generally have big, some might say ugly, decals on the side. And they tend to be boxy. One of the big distinguishing things between an RV and a van is that RVs tend to be built rather than just a vehicle that's been modified. Now, a Class B RV is a van that's simply been modified. But the vast majority of other RVs are actually constructed completely, either on a chassis or on a trailer bed or something like that. So that's one of the big differences. When we talk about van life, we tend to think about people buying a van and converting it themselves. This means that RVs, in many ways, have more support from society. People know what they are. People have expectations for them. There's separate registrations for them. There are dealer networks where you can get support. And campgrounds are much more likely to accept them. Although, many of the folks in older RVs will tell you that some resorts, as they call them now, campgrounds, we used to call them RV resorts, won't allow rigs that are over 10 years old. So if you've got your lovely 2013 Airstream, you may not be able to go certain places because it's too old. Although, from what I hear, they kind of let the Airstream slide because, heck, can't tell what year they are anyway. And it's also interesting that RVs tend to be built for campgrounds. With van life, we tend to think more boondocking, but RVs are basically built to be at a campground. Again, there's exceptions. There are off-road, more boondock-worthy RVs. But in general, RVs are meant to be used in a campground. And though they do have some boondocking capabilities, it's usually much less. One of the things that I find fascinating is when I look at the batteries that come with RVs and the solar, and it's just so wimpy compared to what people are doing in their vans. For example, my ambulance has 300 watts of solar on the roof and 200 amp hours of battery. It's a little more complicated than that, but basically that's it. And that is not a huge build by any means. I mean, people have smaller ones, of course, but there are people with 1,200 watts of solar on their roofs and 800, 1,000 and more amp hours of battery. So I've got a fairly modest build, but it is at least triple what I have on my Airstream, which came with the solar package. It's funny what they consider, oh, yeah, this is a boondocking rig. My ambulance can boondock for a whole lot longer than the Airstream can, except with water. Water is the trickier thing. There's a whole lot more water in the Airstream. So in general, RVs are meant to be hooked up at campgrounds. RVs also tend to be larger, and because they're larger, they're more comfortable. If you are somebody that's looking for the maximum comfort experience, an RV is probably where you're going to be at. But they're also more fragile. Because they are not automotive builds, with the exception of the Class Bs, they're usually made with particle board or plywood or aluminum or fiberglass or some sort of walls. Winnebago's famously had aluminum with foam sandwiched in there, and that was what the walls were made out of. And they're just not as tough as an automotive vehicle. And by when I say automotive, I mean something that was built to be a vehicle, like a van with steel walls and rollover protection and a lot of federal safety protections that RVs do not have. If you're going to get into an accident, you're going to much rather be in a van than in an RV. And you're going to much rather be in a car than a van, but that's another story. The people who do RVing tend to be older folks. They tend to be retirees, or they tend to be families. So you'll have a family of four with an RV. That's very common. Or you'll have an older retired couple in an RV. And they tend to rely more on support. By this, I mean they are much more likely to go someplace to have work done in their rig. They're much more likely to pay somebody to wash their rig and that kind of a thing. And again, this is all a generalization, but RV people see that there are people to help them with things. There are people to help them change their batteries and their tires and all that stuff. And that's not as true in the van life people, but we'll get to that. And finally, RVs are either meant to be towed or can tow. So even your massive RV, you may want to bring a second vehicle with you, and that's just not something that's considered much in vans. Although it certainly happens. People bring bikes with them all the time, but people bring motorcycles. And yeah, some people will tow like a little Jeep behind their van, and that can happen. Now, on the van side of things, like I said, they tend to be homemade or at least custom. Sure, Winnebago makes Class B vans, but the vast majority of us out there doing van life, in quotes, have a van or some similar vehicle that we bought that we built out ourselves, or we've hired somebody to do a build for us. But they're very custom. Everybody's van is different, and this is what makes like things like Van Fest and Schoolie Palooza and all these events interesting, is that everybody's got a totally different rig, and they're all expressions of their personality, and it's just fun to tour them all. Whereas if you go to an RV show, they're all kind of variations of the same thing. It's just they're not as unique to the person. And as I said earlier, vans are definitely more meant for boondocking. And I guess the thought here is that since vans are smaller and more maneuverable and more able to get to difficult places, there's not going to be as much chance of finding a built-out campground there. So yeah, they have to be made for boondocking. Also, van life people tend to have less money than RV people in general. They're much less likely to spend money to park at night, whereas RV people kind of expect to. And that leads to another thing that I don't know that a lot of people think of, but vans are a heck of a lot easier to drive. Now, I know some folks who have only driven small cars their entire life, they see an Econoline and they're like, oh, I don't know if I can ever drive that great big thing. Well, let me tell you, compared to a Class A RV, it's much simpler. It's much less scary than when you sit in a living room couch with this massive steering wheel and you feel like you're driving the world from a living room. That's a completely different experience. It's much easier to drive a van. But as I said earlier again, you have fewer comforts typically in a van. Now, because vans are unique and customized to every single van owner, you can have as many comforts as you want. But because they're smaller, yeah, you're probably not going to have the ability to take a long shower or even stand up in your shower or even have a shower. And these things are fairly common in the RV world. You probably don't have a forced air furnace that can heat the whole thing up in 5 minutes, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, that's obviously a trade-off largely based to size. I mean, you know, if you talk to the schoolie people, which interestingly, the schoolie people seem much more associated with van life than they do with RV life. you know, they've got all these things. Some of them have hot tubs and giant bathtubs and whatever they want in them because those things are huge. And the people who do van life tend to be more independent, in my experience. These are folks who are going to do their own work on their van, who absolutely have no problem climbing under their van with some zip ties to fix something, wouldn't even think twice about it, and even doing more major mechanics than that. I mean, they're always happy to open the hood and do stuff. In general, if you're the kind of person who absolutely would never know how to check the oil or change a tire, RV life might be more for you because you'll have a lot more support. But if you're somebody who can spin balance their own tires in your garage, for example, then van life's going to be no problem. And van lifers tend to be younger. Now, this, of course, isn't always true. There's plenty of older van life people. They've made movies about them. But in my experience, van life folks tend to be much younger. And in many cases, these van life folks, the van is their primary and only vehicle. So it's not like a bonus vehicle like an RV tends to be. It is their primary vehicle. It is their daily driver. And I think, for me, the key defining difference between RV life and van life is exploring. RVers do explore, but they want to do it very comfortably, and they want to be in more of a party and relax mode, whereas van life people want to be more exploring. They want to get out there and see stuff that they haven't seen before. They're much more likely to be rock climbers and hikers and mountain bikers and that kind of a thing. And while there's a huge overlap between the two groups, there are a lot of RVers who are content to just go from campground to campground and set up and make margaritas for everybody in the campground. And that's perfectly fine. It's just a different way of being. So what do you think? Do you disagree with me on any of these? Do you think I'm splitting hairs here? Is RV life and van life exactly the same thing? Let me know at jeff@builttogo.com. That's 2 T's, not 3, not 1. And I will consider what you have to say. But for me, I'm pretty content being in both worlds, although you'll notice I have a van life podcast and not an RV podcast. Thank you to Edwin and Bianca for helping to support this podcast by buying me diesel at buymeacoffee.com/builttogo. If you would like to help us keep ads off of this podcast, please consider making a donation at buymeacoffee.com/builttogo, and we will keep ads off of here forever. And so far, this has worked really great, and I thank everybody who's been involved. I'm thrilled with the response, and I'm very, very happy not to have to deal with ads, as I know you are, too. Tech Talk. So last week I talked about an air conditioning idea that was fairly affordable. And this week I'm going to briefly mention another air conditioning idea that's less affordable, but is much fancier. So undermountac.com, that's the website and the name of the product apparently, Undermount AC. They sell a 12-volt ducted air conditioner that mounts underneath your van, not on the roof, underneath the van. And what it basically will do is provide ducts in the van. So you're mounting this box with two fans on it and a compressor under the van anywhere you want. You can put it way up under there, so you don't have to worry about hitting it with rocks or anything. And then there will be a duct that you have to get into the van. Of course, you're going to have to cut a hole for that. You know, you're not getting away from this. You're not getting away without cutting a hole in your van if you want air conditioning. And that's basically it. You hook this up 12 volts, and there's a fancy electronic thermostat, and boom, you've got 12-volt AC. So why isn't everybody doing this? It seems like the perfect solution. Well, there's a couple reasons. One is that it's $3,600 to start with, so this is significantly more expensive. Another is that it's out of stock. These things are very popular now, and they're having a hard time keeping them in stock. And the other is how much power it draws. Now, we keep talking about this. This is the big problem with air conditioners, is that they draw so much power. And these things draw, you ready for this? 71 amps at 14 volts. At 12 volts, we're talking 83 amps. That means your 100 amp hour battery is basically going to last for 1 hour running this thing. And then, of course, you have to recharge it, which I think is actually the bigger problem. That said, If you're buying a big van, like say a 170, and you've got lots of roof space for solar, and you've got a big enough budget to get maybe 800 amp hours of battery or more, this would be pretty slick. It would be invisible. You couldn't see it from the outside of the van. You'd have a nice, simple control inside. And then it's four ducts in a box, and you could run hoses from them and make air conditioning come out wherever you wanted. But it would be at the top of your van. The cold air would be exactly where you want it. So I mentioned this just as an option. This isn't a product review. I've never used the thing, but this is probably a better solution than what I mentioned last week. It's just 10 times more expensive for the unit, and then maybe 4 times more expensive for the batteries and everything. I mean, you'd have to do the math. But I think you're looking at least $6,500, $7,000 to install this air conditioner unit. I'll have a link in the show notes to it, but it's just undermountac.com. They do have versions that are at higher voltages that are a little bit cheaper, but have lower power demands. 24 and 48 volt air conditioners actually run better than 12 volt air conditioners. But, hey, if you're doing a high-end build, and you're going to spend $50,000 on a build, say, I would definitely take a look at this. Oh, and by the way, I have to mention, I've got to mention Brian Dunning, actually, for two things this week. The first thing I will mention him for is he mentioned that I should have said something about soft start last week. So remember I mentioned that air conditioners have a big surge when they start up? There's this thing called soft start that kind of eliminates that to some degree. Basically, it is a capacitor, and the capacitor will slowly store energy, and then when you turn on the air conditioner, it will release all that energy at once directly to the air conditioner so that your air conditioner doesn't have to draw that surge completely from your electrical system. They're very common on RV air conditioners, and I think if you were clever, you could probably get one to work on a window air conditioner because you basically just have to interrupt the power a little bit. So that's an idea that should be mentioned, and thank you, Brian, for bringing that up. Product review. And now for the second thing Brian brought up. He sent me a text with this. You know, it's funny. I can't find a good name for these things, but they're screws that you put into your tire on purpose. So let's back up here. I've long recommended that everybody doing any sort of travel in vehicles have tire repair kits in your vehicle. Sure, you can always change the spare, but if your spare gets a hole in it, then you're in trouble. It's much easier and cheaper simply to carry an air compressor and some sort of a patch kit. And I have long recommended these. They're basically these sticky string things where you pull the nail or screw out of the tire and then you ream the hole a little bit, and the kit comes with a reamer. And then you cover these black stringy things with some cement, push them in the hole, pull the tool out, and then trim it, and you're done. And it's technically a temporary repair, but how long is temporary? 6 months? 6 years? You get to decide. Anyway, this is a new way of doing this that looks like it's actually a lot easier, and it takes up less space, and it doesn't require as much. So imagine a small screw that's black, kind of covered in plastic, and has a goo on it. That's what these things are, and they come in these little capsules. And the way they work is you get a flat in your tire, which you don't do on purpose in most cases. Remove the screw or nail from your tire, and then immediately take one of these tire screws and screw it into the hole with a screwdriver. You could use a drill too, it doesn't matter, but you're basically going to screw it down until that screw tip is flat or even a little bit recessed into your tire. Now, this is only for the treads, folks. You're not going to be doing this in your sidewalls unless you're in a huge emergency, and then, all right, I'm not going to fault you from doing whatever you have to do to get out of that, but they are only certified for using right in the center of the tread. And yes, they're supposed to be temporary. And no, I haven't tried them out. So this is a product review based on something I've just seen. But they're intriguing. And what I like is that when you buy the kit, you get 15 of two different sizes. You get big ones and little ones. Well, if you have two vehicles, you can just split them up. You don't need any tools to use these, just a screwdriver. So if you have two vehicles or you want to bring one with you on your bike ride, or if you have a motorcycle, whatever, it's easy just to toss a couple in your pack. And they look like they work. All the reviews say that they work pretty well. Flats are a tricky thing. Not every flat is the same. Sometimes you get a slice and you can't use one of these things. But Heck, for the price, they're less than $10. I'll have a link in the show notes. You can get 30 of these things, and it's just another thing to have that could get you out of a jam. And I have them now, so I've got both in my vehicle. The next time I get a flat, I'm going to try these. I'll let you know how it goes. But I'm thinking it's going to go pretty well. The only negative thing I have been able to find about these is that if you're the kind of person who burns rubber, which is not something you want to do in your van very often, spinning the tires against pavement for a prolonged period of time tends to dislodge these. So you have been warned. Tales from the road. Way back in 1988, I was driving a 1983 Toyota Mini Cruiser motorhome as my primary vehicle, and my girlfriend, soon-to-be wife, and some other folks decided that we were going to move to Utah. I lived in Massachusetts at the time, as did my girlfriend, and some of the other people were from New York. Anyway, a bunch of us decided to make Salt Lake City our home. And at the time, it kind of made sense because Salt Lake City was a fairly inexpensive place to live. I mean, we managed to get an apartment that had heat included and a washer and dryer for $190 a month. Now, okay, this is back in 1988. It was a long time ago. But even then, that was a really good deal. The other side of that was jobs didn't pay anything. Compared to Massachusetts, the wages were dismal. But I'm not talking about that. What I'm talking about is getting there. So obviously to drive from Massachusetts to Salt Lake City, you have to drive nearly across the entire country, almost all of it on I-80, which is a road that I am very, very familiar with these days, let me tell you. And I had an experience while driving that was kind of seminal in that it really reset the way I think about the world and how people live. And that was as we're driving across, this is probably day two, we crossed the Mississippi River, we were probably leaving Illinois into Iowa, and we stopped in a campground not far from Davenport, Iowa. Now that's in the Quad Cities area, and it's a fairly populated part of Iowa, which you can't say about a lot of Iowa. And, you know, there's not all that much to say about Davenport. I mean, what do you expect from a place named after a couch? No, I'm kidding. But I had never been to Iowa before. It was literally just a flyover state in my experience. And when I got there and got to the campground, I had two revelations that the way I had been living life is not the only way to live it. The first was, and this was an off time of year, the campground we stopped at, and it was actually a regular campground, wasn't that full. So when we pulled in, all I saw was horizon. I could see the horizon maybe 320 out of 360 degrees. It was all around me. I felt like the tiniest thing standing on a cue ball. I had never been any place that open ever before, with the exception of the ocean. And it was weird. Now, I'd heard that people who have lived in the Southwest moving to New England freak out about how many trees there are. They kind of like, they're claustrophobic. They don't understand how the plane can land because there's so many trees. And when they're driving down the highway, they feel like the trees are closing in on them because they don't see that in the Southwest. You don't drive down tree-lined highways in the Southwest, whereas in New England, that's normal. It's almost everywhere now. But Davenport is flat. It's so flat, and it's such a farm community that, yeah, you can see the horizon everywhere. And it was a weird feeling to me. I suddenly felt like I had nowhere to hide. Like, I was vulnerable, and I couldn't possibly run fast enough to get into cover, which isn't something I knew that I had a need for. You know, that wasn't a thought I had in Massachusetts, which was like, oh, I'm only 20 feet from the trees. I can run in there if I need cover. What cover from what? Giant birds? I don't know. This was an emotion. It was just a feeling. There was nothing rational about it. And it just really changed the way I saw the United States. And of course, now I live in Illinois, and these things are a lot more common than they were then. But that was the first time I had really ever been someplace so flat and open. And then the second thing. So after our driving all this way and being, you know, early 20 folks and, you know, wanting to have a drink when we could, I asked the campground host, you know, where was the nearest bar? And they said, oh, well, this is a dry county. You'll have to go to the next county over. And I said, what's a dry county? I had never heard of counties where you couldn't buy alcohol. And it wasn't until then that I realized that every state, and indeed every county, has completely different liquor laws. And I tell people how we bought liquor in Massachusetts, and they're like, that's weird. See, in Massachusetts, supermarkets, and this is, it may be different now, supermarkets didn't sell any kind of alcohol at all. Beer and wine and liquor you had to get from a package store, affectionately called the Packy. This is like a state liquor store in some states, but it was not run by the state. These were just licensed liquor stores. And there were a few places that had just a beer and wine license, but they weren't very common. So yeah, if you like were going to do a Super Bowl party, you'd go to the supermarket and get all your stuff, but then you'd go to the Packy and get your beer and stuff like that. And I thought that's how it was everywhere. I had no idea that there were state liquor stores or that there were indeed dry counties, places where you couldn't get a drink at all. I still think it's kind of weird that we have all these liquor laws, but if you haven't caught the joke here, the joke is that I was moving to Salt Lake City, the place with the weirdest liquor laws of all. Like, there was a restaurant downtown that had a sign that says, "Food, ghosts, and fun." And I thought this was some kind of a haunted house-themed bar. But no, it was a bar, but it's illegal, or it was in the 80s, it was illegal to announce that you sold alcohol on the premise. And they couldn't even use the word spirits. So they picked the next best thing, which was ghosts. Anyway, travel. See things, and it will change your perspective. And those are a few of the ways it changed mine. A place to visit. How many national parks are there in the United States? If you said 62 because of that game that was very popular last year or the year before, you're wrong! No, the answer is 63 because they added Indiana Dunes in the last few years, which is actually a really nice national park. And it's an under-visited national park. People should go there more. But this week, I want to talk about a national park that I'll bet none of you have been to. I'll bet not a single one of my listeners has ever been to this particular national park. And if I'm wrong, let me know. Please send me an email at jeff@builttogo.com. That's 2 T's, not 3, not 1. And let me know if you visited this place. And if you have, I know one thing for certain. You didn't take your van there. No, this isn't a place on an island. I'm not talking about like a park on Guam or anything like that. I'm talking about Gates of the Arctic in Alaska. This is the least visited national park in the entire system. And that's partially because there are no roads there. You can only get there by plane or by hiking. In fact, if you want to go there at all, you basically have to go to Fairbanks and then arrange for hundreds of miles of travel just to get into this park. It's an incredible amount of work. I completely understand why this is not all that visited. Apparently, you can get there from the Dalton Highway. You can drive near there, but then you have to hike for a very, very long time and can get as close as Cold Foot. But it's a 2-lane industrial road with no services at all, and they don't recommend you do that. But man, if you can get to this place, it's pretty amazing. Oh, by the way, talk about numbers here. When I say it's the least visited, how many people do you think go there? You know, I mean, we have Yosemite has millions of visitors every year. How many people go to Gates of the Arctic? Well, in 2020, there were 2,872 people who visited this entire place. This entire park that's 8.5 million acres. It's gigantic, and there's nobody there, and that's what's really cool about it, and I would really like to go there. This is pristine wilderness, and it was why it was preserved in 1980, and you have to really want to see this place. If you're trying to do your completionist thing of seeing all 63 national parks, you're going to have to do some work to see this one, but I really think it's going to be worth it. Camping is permitted anywhere in the park, basically. You can just head out with your tent and camp anywhere you want. There are some native lands in there that you have to watch out for, but you're going to do enough planning that you're going to avoid that. You are definitely going to want to go in the summer. This is serious winter country here, and I don't think it would be safe. But let me just give you a list of some of the many animals that live here. brown bears, a.k.a. grizzly bears, black bears, muskox, moose, doll sheep, timberwolves, wolverines, coyotes, lynx, arctic ground squirrels, lemmings, voles, marmots, porcupines, river otters, red and arctic fox, beavers, wood frogs, heck, I've got them in Tiki Bagoland, snowshoe hares, collared pikas, muskrats, arctic terns, bald eagles, golden eagles, peregrine falcons, ospreys, great horned and northern hawk owls, and over 500,000 caribou. There's a lot of critters up here. What an amazing place to be able to visit. Now, this is not completely devoid of people. People have lived here for almost 13,000 years. But there's no civilization, as we'd call it. There are no cities. There are no towns. There's nothing like that. So, folks, if you really want to get out there and really see the wilderness, you're going to have to leave your van behind. But then you get to check off Gates of the Arctic National Park and Preserve. And it is the largest contiguous wilderness in the entire United States. And that's including Alaska, because that's where it is. Also, it's some really crazy steep mountains. I mean, anyway, I'm getting a little obsessed here. But yeah, go visit this place. I dare you. I would love to do it. I don't know when I'm going to be able to, if ever. But if I ever get the chance, I'm going to do it. Gates of the Arctic National Park and Preserve in the great state of Alaska. Resource recommendation. So doing research for these tire screw things that I've never used, I did some YouTube, and I found this great video on tire repair. Now, this is not the most riveting video you're ever going to see in your life. It is just basically a guy repairing tires four different ways, and he does something I've never seen before, which is that not only does he walk you through exactly how to do it, he shows you the inside of the tire as the patches go in, so you understand what's going on. Now, he tests four different tire things. One is the traditional strip plug, and then there is the sticky string strip plug, which are almost exactly the same thing. There is the mushroom patch, which is like a big mushroom of rubber that you have to use a special tool to insert, but it looks pretty good. And then finally, the screws that we just talked about. And it's interesting to me that in the video, the part he spends the least time on is the screws, and that's the appeal. You're done in 15 seconds with these things. You don't have to mess around. There's no cleanup. There's nothing to trim. So I recommend everybody watch this video before you need to, or just keep it bookmarked for when you do need it, because it will show you how to repair your tires these four different ways. But there is something interesting that's brought up. First, they're very careful to mention that these are temporary repairs. Officially, every time you use one of these, you're then supposed to go to a tire professional and have your tire checked or replaced or changed or professionally repaired. Also, these repairs are only supposed to be used in the center of the tread, never on the sidewalls and never on what are called the shoulders, which are the edges of the tread. However, that's official. That's lawyers talking, and officially, that's my recommendation, because I don't want to be responsible for you doing something that's going to harm yourself. However, for me personally, if I'm in an emergency situation and I need to get out of there, I'm going to try to use one of these plugs anywhere. I have used them in the sidewall of a tire. I actually popped a tire in Death Valley, and that's how I got out of there. If you drive through Death Valley enough, you'll see these giant spines, and eventually one's going to find its way into your tire. And that's what happened to me. And I didn't air down my tires on this trip, which helped that thing get in there. And I basically had a flat tire, and it was dark. And I was like, I don't want to have to change a tire out here in the dust and stuff. So I just put a patch in the sidewall. Got me all the way back to Vegas with no problems. But again, I can't recommend that you do that. That's just something I did. So, something to think about. Anyway, watch this video. It's called Tire Plug Repair Kits, Which is Best? And it's from the channel Knobs, Dials, and Buttons. A really well done video. Well, folks, thank you very much for listening to episode 209. Music, as always, is by Simon Wagg. If you need to get a hold of me for any reason, you can find me on our Discord channel, at the Facebook group, or you can send me an email at jeff@builttogo.com. That's two T's, not three, not one. And until next time, remember the words of Parker Palmer, who said, "When the going gets rough, turn to wonder."